having worked half the night of the 24th and 25th and settled into the safari beds in new surroundings, it seemed only an hour or so before a roar from the duty leading hand invited us in no uncertain terms to rise and shine. It was obviously his job to ensure that no one overslept, but as this was at some unearthly hour of 06:30, we thought that he must have made a mistake, thinking we were sailors. We retaliated by reminding him that we were Air Force, and so perhaps his early morning call didn't apply to us. He was, in fact, a telegraphist air gunner from the Swordfish Squadron, a couple of whose aircraft were retained on board, together with a couple of Sea Hurricanes. As he towered above me on my safari bed, wearing his teddy bear flying jacket, etc., he seemed enormous and not the sort of chap to argue with, so he got up and started to prepare for the first day of the proper aircraft assembly programme. Our working day was from 8 o'clock in the morning to 23:59, midnight, with time out for meals, of course, and throughout all the foregoing activities, and from then on, Squadron Leader Shorty Hughes, or who was our engineer officer, was always on the ball, encouraging, organising, and often had his jacket off to give a hand. We had been organised into gangs by trades. We riggers, that's the airframe trade name, were in eight gangs, each with a corporal in charge, with three of us under his control, and each gang had two Spitfires to build. Those of us with little experience started to learn quickly. Fitters, that's the engine trades, had their coolant systems, etc., to connect and fill, props to install and the like. Electricians, instruments and radio trades were obviously in the minority. Armourers were kept well occupied with installation of cannon and machine guns, building up ammunition and subsequently the harmonisation of the armament and gun sights. A high proportion of the NCOs and IRCs I found were from maintenance units used to handling repairs and major components on Spitfires at fighter airfields. My gang was led by Ted Foster, who at the time was a senior leading aircraftsman, there not being enough corporals to go round in our trade. This resulted in Sergeant Richardson taking a close interest in our efforts, as all our work recorded in the Form 700 had to be oversigned by an NCO. I worked on the installation of tailplanes, elevators and rudders, together with the connection of associated flying control runs as an AC-1 with George Allwright, who had been on repairs to Spitfires at various stations in South England. Ted Foster and Harry Parry worked on the completion of the attachment of main planes to fuselage and the connection of systems at the route end, i.e. aileron controls, undercarriage jacks and controls, pneumatics for operation of flaps, gun cocking, gun firing, wheel brakes and landing extension, and the mechanical operation of the radiator shutters. Once all this had been done and tested as best we could in the hangar and the other trades were ready, the aircraft was taken onto the lift, brought up onto the flight deck for engine runs and fuel transfer checks from the 90-gallon jettisonable tank slung below the fuselage centre section. Eventually, the armourers would take over to do their harmonisation. As soon as essentials were finished on our first aircraft, we moved to the second, and of course there was a bit of competition between the gangs to see who made the best progress each day. Shorty Hughes, assisted by Warrant Officer Connors, Flight Sergeant Scadden and a handful of sergeants kept everything on the move, but took opportunity to assess how we youngsters were coping. Around midnight, Shorty would make his rounds and tell those of us who showed signs of fatigue that we had better get some sleep. Flight Sergeant Scadden seemed to inherit the job of getting the aircraft moved around the hangar, up on deck or on and off the lift, and was dubbed tail arm, as he always had a tail steering arm to hand. As before, flight deck work was carefully monitored and ground running, harmonisation, etc., was undertaken under cover of darkness. Work continued through February the 25th and 26th, and at about 2 o'clock on February the 27th, we put to sea to proceed towards Malta. But after about 20 hours, the operation was cancelled and we turned back to Gib. Our escort included another carrier, HMS Argus, a battleship, HMS Malaya, a heavy cruiser and 10 destroyers. Depth charges were dropped, but there was no apparent enemy activity, although it was always expected. We were back in Gib by 2200 hours on the 28th of February, by which time most of the assembly work had been completed. One aircraft had been nominated as a Christmas tree, from which spares could be borrowed when required, assuming they were not otherwise available. There had been considerable troubles during engine runs in getting reliable fuel transfer from the 90-gun and drop tanks. The tank was located below the centre section of the fuselage, roughly between the undercarriage legs, and was held to the aircraft by a spigot on the top of the tank, engaging a housing in the underside of the fuselage, which included a locking mechanism which could be released from the cockpit. Two hooks were fitted to the bottom of the fuselage, just about the rear edge of the tank. The tank was formed from light alloy as a flat, streamlined shape, and when jettisoned in the air was intended to fall away, the two hooks preventing it from sliding backwards with consequent risk of damage to the aircraft. A filler cap was provided at the upper part of the front of the tank, and fuel was transferred by suction through a spring-loaded connection standing proud of the tank top, which lined up with a connection more or less flush with the underside of the fuselage. Suitable washers and liberal quantities of grease were used to make an airtight connection between the tank connection and the aircraft fuel system as the tank was locked up to the fuselage. There was also a vent pipe running along the top of the tank with the aft end open.